Hi all, this is Ryan Rodzeski here, and I just wanted to pop in to let you know that what you're about to hear is an interview that Greg and I did with Dr. Vivek Murthy, our nation's former Surgeon General. It's going to sound a little bit different than what you're used to because we originally recorded this as part of a group with AASA, the School Superintendents Association. But we wanted to share it here because some of the things Dr. Murthy covers, social media, mental health, the importance of human connection, are applicable to schools, to families, to all the folks who regularly join us here on Remaking Tomorrow. So we hope you enjoy. Let's get into it.
Dr. Vivek Murthy was confirmed by the United States Senate in March 2021 to serve as the 21st Surgeon General of the United States. This was actually the second time he'd answer the call, because Dr. Murthy was also our 19th Surgeon General under President Barack Obama. As the nation's doctor, the Surgeon General's mission is to help lay the foundation for a healthier country, relying on the best scientific information available to provide clear, consistent, and equitable guidance and resources for the public. And as Vice Admiral of the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, Dr. Murthy commands a uniformed service of over 6,000 dedicated public health officers, serving the most underserved and vulnerable populations domestically and abroad. So please welcome our nation's Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Dr. Vivek Murthy. As Surgeon General, some of your chief responsibilities include being a communicator of knowledge, distilling the latest, most cutting-edge science into a form that the rest of us can understand. And the wisdom that you share helps others to make more informed decisions in their own lives. And a striking number of your office's current key priorities focus on children, young people, and their families. So let's start with those young people and with issues of youth mental health. Your office notes, Dr. Murthy, that mental health challenges are the leading cause of disability and poor life outcomes in our young people. Simultaneously, in recent years, we've seen significant increases in certain mental health disorders in our young people. So how do we start to equip the adults in their lives, and particularly the educators, to support a growing number of kids through the increasingly difficult mental health challenges? What are the resources or supports that we adults might need?
Well, thanks for that question, Greg. And let me just say from the outset how grateful I am to be here with all of you. And Greg, Ryan, Christine, to the whole team, thank you so much for inviting me in. I'll tell you why this is sort of especially meaningful to me. I've always felt, ever since I went to medical school, that there's a tight connection between educators and doctors, that they, even though their jobs seem very different, they actually in many ways are very similar, including the highlights and also some of the challenges. On the challenges side, both of them have broad responsibilities and are constantly asked to do more and more and more without the sort of commensurate resources and support to do that. Primary care doctors in particular usually have everything put on their plate that everyone else feels is important, but no one quite knows how to execute that. And teachers, educators are very, very similar. But we also, in both professions, have this incredibly important and just vital role that society has asked us to take on, which is to look after people in the most holistic way possible, to think not just about the math that they learn or the literature that they learn or the treating their diabetes or their high blood pressure, but to really think of them as whole people and think about how we can nurture them so that they can heal and prosper and do well in the future. And that's a profound responsibility. It's an extraordinarily large task, especially now, but it is vital for society. To me personally, as a father of two kids who are in school right now, but how important it's going to be for the country going forward. You know, as we think about the mental health challenges that you mentioned, Greg, you know, I've been just so concerned about the broader youth mental health crisis that we've been living through. I think the pandemic certainly made things worse in terms of youth mental health, but this is a problem that was building for years. And part of what we, you know, I think have recognized is that, number one, if we don't see it clearly for what it is, then we're not able to deal with it. And that's been part of our work, is to try to pull the curtain back on the broader impact and extent of the youth mental health crisis. But then it's also been to, you know, raise, you know, the question of what we can do about it, and then to lay out pathways that we can take, solutions, if you will. And here, I think there's a lot that we can do. On the one side, there's the importance of getting care for people who need it, right? So expanding our access to mental health care and bringing it closer to where students are. And that means, like, you know, in schools or like in their communities or in their homes sometimes, and sometimes on their devices. So that's a vital piece of it. But the other half of it has to involve prevention, looking at what the root causes are that are driving the broader youth mental health crisis, and then thinking about how we address those, whether those are loneliness and isolation, trauma and violence in people's lives, the experience of social media, which has too often been harmful for many kids. Like, all of these constitute elements and sources of pain, if you will, that are driving the youth mental health crisis that we have to ultimately address. Doing that is not easy. And so fundamentally, what we have laid out are not just actions that policymakers can take and that schools and educators can take, but we've also called for a much broader and stronger sense of community whereby we can do this together, recognizing that one school or one educator on their own may be limited in what they can do. But if we work together and learn from each other in how to, for example, manage technology and social media for kids, or how to build social connection into the life, you know, of students and into their school sort of environment, if we can help each other do that, then we're going to be much, much more successful at addressing the broader mental health crisis. It's hard for us to do any of this work well if we're also not taking care of the mental health of educators themselves. And we've seen this in medicine too, where when doctors and nurses and other health providers are burning out at high levels, that impairs their ability to take good care of patients or to care for them the way they really want to. And that actually creates a vicious cycle, because people go into our professions, education, medicine, often not for the paycheck, but for the ideals, for the desire to serve and to care for other people. And when we feel we're unable to do that, either because we're asked to do too much or too little resources, or because the challenges are too great, that actually erodes our sense of self-efficacy, and that contributes to burnout.
Dr. Murthy, you brought up social media, which I really appreciate, because we see this sort of thing in headlines almost every day now. It's been argued that many of these youth mental health challenges are related to this sort of near universal use of social media by young people. And I'm being careful there and saying related to and not caused by, because I know there's some disagreement there. But your office has noted that kids and adolescents who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media, which is a lot of kids, face double the risk of mental health problems, including experiences of depression and anxiety. And one of the things we appreciate about your work is that you often outline solutions at so many different levels, right? What we can do as a nation, what we can do as institutions and as individuals. And when it comes to social media in particular, we know that parents and caregivers have a role to play. Tech companies have a role to play. Policymakers have a role to play. How is it that we might make the experience of social media for young people healthier and happier as school districts and school leaders?
Well, that's a really important question. And I actually think it's one of the most urgent questions for us to address, because, you know, I've become fairly convinced that social media has become one of the important drivers of the youth mental health crisis. Not the only one, but certainly an important one. And I know that there are discussions about the need for more research in this space. There's always a need for more research. There are always going to be more questions we need to answer. And part of this has been hindered by the fact that independent researchers tell us all the time that they can't get all the data they need from companies, from the platforms, to fully assess the impact on the mental health of kids. But we know enough now to be able to take action. We know, number one, that there is not evidence actually of safety. Most products that kids use, including medications, require some demonstration of safety. That doesn't exist when it comes to social media. We've not demonstrated safety. That in and of itself should be a point of concern. But on top of that, we have the data you mentioned that we laid out in our report in 2023, the association between 3 hours plus of social media use a day and a doubling of anxiety and depression symptoms among adolescents. And by the way, the average use per day among adolescents is 4.8 hours a day. So it's well above that 3 hour mark. But we also have to look at what young people are telling us directly, right? So this is actually very important. On surveys and studies, young people themselves are speaking to the harms of social media. Half of adolescents say social media makes them feel worse about their body image. A third of adolescent girls say they feel addicted to social media. And we have a third of adolescents staying up till midnight or later on school nights using their devices, and much of that is social media use. And then finally, just look at what happens when you actually take social media away from someone, give them a break. What you find is initially, like with anything else you might have an unhealthy dependence on, you can feel jittery. you know, after a while. And many of us will recognize this because in your own life, right, if you go a period of time without access to your phone, which am I used to having, you recognize your hand is slipping into your pocket, looking for your phone, your thumb is looking for something to refresh. Like, it's a part of what we've gotten used to. But when you actually follow those studies out and look at how do people feel and fare with their mental health after a longer period of time, like a couple of weeks of being without social media, the studies actually show when you parse it that way, people actually seem to do better. And lastly, the thing I can't get out of my head that haunts me are just the many, many instances where I've met with parents and sat with them and heard about how their child, after during a period of vulnerability, when they were struggling with a relationship breakup or when they were having a difficult time because they, you know, tried to do something or disappointed, whether it was making a team or achieving something academically, that during that vulnerable phase, that when they went to social media looking for help, that the algorithm ended up pushing content to them and videos to them that encouraged them to harm themselves. Mm. And if this seems like it's a terrible thing that should never happen, you're right. It's a terrible thing that should never happen. Yet I think about all these conversations with moms and dads who say that their child in many cases ended up not only harming themselves, but in some cases taking their own life after they received this kind of content, you know, on social media. You put all of that together, and any notion that we should wait to do anything to address this and just wait for more data, in my mind, is this does not make sense. And it is actually, I think, irresponsible. We would never, if we had this much evidence of harm, and if we had a complete lack of safety data, we would never say that this is a product that kids should use widely and that they should not be worried about and that parents should have no concerns about. Because right up until now, all the burden of managing this is on the shoulders of parents and educators and children, which I think is not only ineffective, but frankly unfair. So what can we do about this? The good thing is there is a lot. Congress has a responsibility, I believe, to step up and put safety measures in place to make social media safer, to protect kids from harmful content, addictive features, from bullying and harassment online, especially from strangers, from privacy and confidentiality violations. Well, all of that is true. Here's what I think we can do in our individual lives and in our schools. I think two things in for schools in particular. Number one is we can help start conversations among young people about the effects that social media is having on them. As much as young people communicate, I've been actually quite struck by how little they talk to each other about their concerns about social media, right? So the more we're able to broker these conversations, the more young people will be able to openly communicate about this, but also not feel ashamed about the fact that they may be struggling with how social media is making them feel. And this, again, doesn't have to be teachers from on high telling them, hey, this is what you can't do and shouldn't do, although I think digital education is vital. But there's also a role for students talking to each other more openly, and we can convene those kind of conversations in schools. The second thing I would mention, though, that schools can do is actually help create spaces like in the educational experience that are actually tech-free, where students can actually engage directly with educators and with each other and with the material without necessarily being on their devices and engaging with social media. And I recognize that increasingly we've had more educational content that's been placed on devices. Here's the challenge that we're facing is that many, you know, students will also be able to access social media on their phones. And so if they have their phone in their hand, there's a good chance that they may be accessing their account and checking their feed and posting and commenting and liking other people's posts. And so, you know, trying to divorce those is a strategy I have seen taken where more and more parents I've seen are opting to give their kids devices that don't have access to apps. But the point is devices that give you the connectivity you need for safety, but don't necessarily give you access to social media. But there are also schools that have taken an even a bolder approach of saying, you know what, we're actually not going to allow the use of phones in the classroom or during learning time. They may have carve outs during lunchtime or during recess or, you know, at various points in the day. They're all different strategies for how to do one common thing, which is to create space for students to be able to learn and engage with each other without technology. This is really, really vital because we, as human beings, I think we sometimes assume, especially if we grew up in a generation without having, you know, smartphones, we assume that people just learn how to socialize and engage and build relationships with each other. But that's actually a skill that is learned over time. And if you are constantly on your devices and most of your interactions with other people are on your devices, you actually don't necessarily build that social skill and that social muscle. And that makes it then harder for people to go up to somebody they don't know and start a conversation.
I'm thinking about myself. I've got a 13-year-old daughter. We have a great relationship. The few arguments that we have always seem to be over the phone, right? I don't argue with her when we get into a car to put on the seatbelt because it's an expectation, right? So, you know, we parents, we educators could benefit from some help at the state or federal level. So if we can give you the policy magic wand, what are one or two things you'd like to see state governments or federal governments do on this particular matter? If you can answer that question and
I think states are already trying to take action on their own, but I think this is one of those areas where you really do need a federal solution here, because if you have like a different law in one state and then a kid goes to another state and transfers, and then you've got, I mean, you need to have uniform rules so that everyone can ideally be operating under the same safety parameters, right? And have the same sort of floor of safety, if you will. Here are a few things that I think are critical. Number one, policymakers need to require that companies are transparent and disclose the data they have about the impact of their platforms on mental health. And they need to disclose those publicly so that parents have them, but also so that independent researchers can assess and analyze that data to understand the full impact on our kids. Companies all the time talk about the safety measures they're putting in place. What I really care about is, are those actually working? Are they making a significant difference? Are they solving the problem? Or are they well-intended window dressing? That's the question that ultimately data needs to address. The second thing I would do with policy is to require that companies protect and shield kids from harmful content. That's extreme violence, it's pornography, content which kids have unfortunately too ready access to right now on social media. The third thing I would require is that they actually establish and enforce age requirements, right? You know, companies will say that right now 13 is the age at which kids can start using their platforms. Yet somehow 40% of kids who are 8 through 12 are using social media. How does that happen if you're actually enforcing your rules? The bottom line is they're not being enforced. And by the way, if you go across the pond to the United Kingdom, those numbers are even higher. It's over 60% of kids in that age range are on social media. And so I would require that enforcement. And then finally, I think there are the privacy pieces which we have to pay attention to. 60% of adolescent girls say they've been contacted by strangers on social media in ways that made them feel uncomfortable. It should not be open season on kids when it comes to social media and contact from strangers. Like, we should protect them from that content. That is something that social media companies can do. And finally, just think about the features themselves. It's not just about the content. It's about the medium itself. Many kids say that they have a hard time getting off of social media. I remember one stop that I went to on our college tour where a student said to me, my parents live very close to campus. We're just about 20 minutes away. And a lot of times if I have a block of time, I'll decide, hey, I want to go see my family. I want to hang out with them. And I'll have a 3-hour block. And I think I'll just check social media. I'll check my account just real quickly for 10 minutes. And then I'll head over. And then 2 hours later, I'm still there. She's like, I've tried so many times to reduce my utilization, but I can't do it. And she was feeling guilty. She was feeling like this is her fault. She was a bad person. She was defective in some way. But I'll tell you this, you know, the generation of young people growing up today do not have a defect in the willpower gene, right? There's not real gene for willpower, but you know what I mean? Like they're not defective, like sort of in terms of their ability to summon their will. Because what's affecting them, it turns out, actually is affecting a lot of us as adults too, right? Like, a lot of adults would talk about how they struggle to limit their time, like on social media, and stay within their own parameters. What's happening is that you've got the best product engineers in the world, funded by the best resource companies in the world, using cutting edge neuroscience to figure out how to maximize how much time we spend on their platforms. And because this is what the business model is based in. That's a fundamental problem for our kids, because in adolescents in particular, when their brains are developing, right, there's a critical phase of brain development where they're more susceptible to social suggestion, social comparison, but also where impulse control has not developed as much. And so what I would finally want to do with policy is to ensure that kids are not exposed to these kind of features that would seek to manipulate their developing brains into excessive use. And that's everything from infinite scroll to the like button to autoplays on videos. All of these are very intentionally put in to keep our kids on. And that comes at the expense, unfortunately, of in-person time, sleep, learning, and physical activity.
Thank you. Dr. Morthy, just one more question from Greg and I. And that is, you know, the challenges you've been discussing all play into and maybe even exacerbate another issue that you've been discussing in recent years, which is what you call our crisis of loneliness. You've written really beautifully about this loneliness in official advisories, in some New York Times op-eds. At first, you know, it might seem like a strange thing for a Surgeon General to focus on. You know, I think of your predecessor, Dr. Koop, and his battle against smoking. You have taken up loneliness, and for a couple of reasons. One, of course, it has mental health impacts, but as you write, it has real physical impacts as well. I'm curious, what drew you to the problem of loneliness? What inspired you to first write about it? And how do you see this issue manifesting in young people and the people who care for them?
Ryan, it's really interesting. If you look at the evolution of medicine in particular, we have moved forward over time in widening our aperture, our lens, and how we look at health, and recognizing that there are more factors that impact our overall well-being than maybe we recognized some years ago. Decades ago, people would have said that mental health isn't really an important part of overall health. And since in the last couple of decades, we've seen a real shift in that. People are recognizing, oh, actually, hold on. This is really important for our well-being, and mental health actually impacts physical health too. There's a third dimension here of health that we have been now focusing on, which has been social health. Mm-hmm. And that is related to loneliness and isolation. And we're realizing that your social health profoundly impacts your mental and physical health. So people who struggle with being socially disconnected, for example, they face double the risk of depression, overall an increased risk of depression, anxiety, and suicide, but also an increased risk of heart disease, of dementia among older people, of premature death, so much so that we see that the mortality associated with social disconnection is on par with the mortality we see associated with smoking and with obesity. And again, we think of smoking and obesity as classic public health issues, right? Sure. It turns out that social connection is an important public health issue as well. I actually had, as a child, experienced a lot of loneliness myself, you know, struggling to make friends as a shy and introverted kid. And I was worrying if I'd have somebody to sit next to in the cafeteria. And while that got a bit better as I got older and as I built confidence, like in high school and then in college, it was something I struggled with, you know, for much of my life. And when I became a doctor, even though I didn't learn about this in med school, I started to realize a lot of my patients were actually struggling with loneliness. I remember one particular patient who I wrote about in one of the pieces you mentioned, Ryan, who actually literally won the lottery, which is like, you know, everyone thinks, oh my God, it would be incredible to win the lottery. But what happened to him is when he won the lottery, he quit his job. He left the neighborhood that he had lived in for many, many years. And he moved out to the Oceanside, bought this like really big house in a gated community, and thought, gosh, now I'm living the life. But what he realized is that he was profoundly lonely. He didn't have the colleagues that he loved spending time with at work. He didn't have clients who really enjoyed the products that he made. He didn't have neighbors who he'd gotten to know over the years who saw each other. Instead, he was in this walled off community, living in a house that had big walls around it with no work colleagues and nobody whose life he was impacting. So he felt. And shortly after that, he developed high blood pressure and diabetes. Mm-hmm. And that's what brought him in to come see me. And so, you know, when we really look at it closely, we realize that the social connection piece really matters to our health. And what I came to see when I started my first term as Surgeon General was, as I traveled the country, so many people had stories of loneliness. And the people who are struggling the most with loneliness are actually young people, despite, and in some cases, because of how connected they may be and tethered to technology. I've come to see that this is not just an American issue, by the way, but this is a global issue now. And I found this to be true in Japan. I found it to be true in the United Kingdom. This has become a global struggle because it's in part a product of so many of the trappings of modern living, whether it's the fact that we move around more, we see each other less, technology has brought us great conveniences, but made it less necessary for us to see each other. Social media has fundamentally changed our dialogue, our ability to interact with each other. All of these things are coming together to ultimately isolate us more, which is why we have to proactively, in ways that we didn't do in prior generations, we have to proactively rebuild the social fabric of our lives and our communities.
Dr. Morthy, I hope everyone here, they go running for the advisory opinions, the articles that you and your team have published and distributed, because we need hope squads full of relationships, purpose, and service all across this country. And if you allow, in the spirit of human connection, I want to end with a fun exclamation point, because look, this is really special. You're two-time Surgeon General. You are a research scientist. You are a physician. You are an entrepreneur. You're a dad. And it turns out you're also a guy who likes mangoes. So, what's the most inventive mango-flavored food or drink that you've enjoyed in the recent past?
Oh my gosh. Well, my favorite preparation of mangoes is actually fresh mango off of our trees in Miami. I grew up
Ooh.
in Miami. My parents immigrated from India and they sought to recreate India in the backyard. For them, that meant planting lots of varieties of mangoes. We have nine different varieties of mangoes that grow on different trees in our yard. You know, when season comes, I love to go down there with my wife, Alice, and our two kids. And we'll, together with my parents, we'll just walk in the yard, pick mangoes, eat them right there. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like a fresh mango. It's right off the tree. It is, it's truly something.
Well, I join you in that mango aficionado-dom, if that's whatever the word is. We are so grateful for your service. We are so grateful for your relationship with us and for the purpose that you clearly live every day. Thank you, Dr. Murthy.
Thank you so much. What a joy to be with all of you today.
Thank you all so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Vivek Murthy, our nation's former Surgeon General. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.